Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Peter Moore. At the end of a very peculiar, and let's face it, quite testing year, Christmas is almost upon us. In this indulgent episode of Travels Through Time, we're off to discover the rich history of our favourite Christmas foods. Over the past 5 months, Violet, John, Artemis and I have had a hugely enjoyable time exploring specific moments in the past with some of the best historical tour guides imaginable. In this third season of Travels Through Time, we've roamed from the Neanderthals to the Beatles, over 25 episodes, and the best part of 100,000 of you have come along for the ride as well. Thank you very much for listening. If you have enjoyed our work, then please do let us know via our website or by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or by simply telling a friend about us. Everything just helps us to keep making more episodes in the future. In compensation, as we round off season 3, we're going to give away some signed hardback history books as Christmas presents. More about that at the end. Of course, we also have a fabulous Christmas special for you today as well. Today's guest is Penn Vogler, the author of the acclaimed new book, Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain. Recently picked as a book of the year by the Sunday Times, Scoff gives the reader a veritable banquet of delicacies through the ages. From the slippery history of jelly to the controversial question of cutlery, it's bursting with stories and unusual recipes for you to try out at home. For this special episode, we've decided to meddle with our format for once. Instead of limiting our guests to 1 year in the past, we've restricted them to just one day. So here is Penn Vogler taking Violet Moller on a tour back to the 25th of December in 3 different years.
Welcome to Travels Through Time, Penn Vogler.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I'm very much looking forward to our festive episode. And we're going to be talking about your book, Scoff, which has just been published. Is that correct?
Yes. What was last month? November. That's right. Yes.
Well, congratulations. It's a feast of a book. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
It's just full of so many great stories and so interesting. And I wonder how did you get the idea? Is this something you've been thinking about for a while?
There was a very specific moment, actually, when the idea emerged, and it came because a colleague and brilliant historian, Tom Penn, said to me, we were talking about the move from the Tudor palate to the Georgian palate. And he said, well, why did it change? You know, why did we lose that taste for all those spices? And I thought about it for a while, and I thought it's got to be the changing structure of our social class. It's got to be something to do with the fact that more kind of women, more housewives, a kind of bigger and bigger middle class were being much more influential about what we ate. And it became obvious quite quickly that if that was to do with social class, then so many other things about why we eat, about what we eat today, are to do with social class. And so, you know, I thought about it for many, many years. So it probably took me about 8-9 years to think about and write.
That's not surprising, though, because the amount of research that you've obviously done, and I mean, it's really, really impressive. It covers the period of history from 1066 to today, which is a huge amount of time. And as you say, different styles of food, different tastes, so many social changes. And I wondered, how did you do the research? What kind of sources were you using? How did you bring it all together?
I mean, I'm very lucky because food history is becoming, you know, a discipline in itself. And so had I done it sort of even 20 or 30 years ago, there'd have been a real paucity of sources. But people have been writing about food history now for the last kind of 10 or 20 years. But I think the most interesting sources are always the cookery books of the time, but also the literature of the time, you know, so what Jane Austen or what Thackeray is saying about food, or how Hogarth is kind of portraying it, or Bruegel, or if you go back to the, you know, the Bayeux tapestry, what truths are literally being embroidered about the difference between Normans and Anglo-Saxon kind of eating and drinking and dining styles. So I think for me, the importance in terms of sources was just to be quite wide and not just what was happening, but what people thought about what was happening, you know, what people were saying at the time, how they were trying to manipulate each other or change each other, or how they were trying to present themselves at the time, became incredibly important.
Yes, and of course, food is intimately connected with so many other political changes, or there's obviously a huge link between spices and trade and the growth of the empire. I mean, there's just so many connections. It kind of imbues everything, doesn't it, food?
Yes, I could have tried to do the book as a kind of worldwide thing, and I absolutely couldn't, you know, I had to kind of draw a line around more or less what we now call Great Britain. But yes, I mean, in terms of how our views of kind of immigrant food, or our views of spices, or our views of, you know, fresh food, or, you know, how every so often somebody comes along and resets the clock and makes us think about things in a different way. So obviously Elizabeth David does that, you know, in terms of looking at kind of Italian and French and European food. So yes, influences are incredibly important, but I just had to kind of put each of them through this lens of class and status, and how people took all those influences and managed to kind of make them part of this kind of hierarchy that we seem to be quite obsessed about in Britain.
And how do you think the historians, food historians of the future, will look back on our own age and our own attitudes to food? Because it seems, you know, over the last couple of decades, we have really begun to fetishize food and obsess over food in quite new ways, I think. I mean, even if I think back to my own childhood in the early 80s, you know, food we ate was quite different in many ways, but also the way we thought about food, I think, was quite different.
I think that's such an interesting question. And of course, as with any history, it depends where we end up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because if we manage to end up in 30 years' time with a kind of broadly egalitarian food system, we might look back at now and say things that happened, such as the pandemic, for example, managed to make us understand the unequal food system we've got at the moment was just not something that we wanted to have in our society. You know, all the stuff that kind of Marcus Rashford is doing around free school meals and that sort of thing. And, you know, I end my book by saying I just hope that some historian takes it off the shelf in the future and dusts it down and scoffs at it, because thinking, why on earth would you write that book about food and class? It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter anymore. And it so much depends on what's happening in terms of our politics at the moment, in terms of, you know, what the Brexit deal or ends up with depends on what kind of food we get in the future. So, and also our relationship and how we perceive ourselves as our relationship to the land, to people who produce food, to the, you know, to fishermen and women and to farmers, all those things kind of have to go in the pot. And whatever we end up with, I think will determine what people think of now. There are obviously some positive arcs, and it might be that this is seen as the beginning of a kind of acknowledgement that we perhaps didn't have in the 70s or 60s or 50s, that food is an important part of our kind of cultural and social life, but also an important part of our emotional lives. And the idea that you have security and you have food security, and it's at the centre of your kind of family or kind of friendship group.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hoping that that's what we end up with, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly, it must be a, we must be in a golden age in terms of what is on offer. I mean, I think that there was a statistic you put in the beginning of your book about there are 90,000 items available in the whole Tesco's system. Is that, was it correct? Was it Tesco's? I can't remember, but one of the big supermarkets.
Yes, it was Tesco. Yeah. And I think it was a few years ago, because I think they even thought, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous. We might need to slim down a little bit. But
yeah, and presumably that's not all food, no, but still, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a huge, yeah. huge
yeah.
number.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So this week, we're abandoning the usual tradition of asking you which year mm-hmm. you'd like to go back to. And instead, we are going to focus very much on one day of the year, which is, of course, Christmas Day, the 25th of December. For your three scenes, I believe we're going to visit three different periods in history on Christmas Day and just talk about the kind of food that people would have been looking forward to eating. So shall we start with your first scene? Will you tell us where we're going and what's on the menu?
So we're going to a kind of pivoting year, and in all honesty, we don't know exactly which year it is. It might be 1524, it might be 1526, but it is...
That's fine.
But it
we
is...
We can so, be relaxed.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of early Tudor. It is the year, and it's a year where we can contrast what is happening on Christmas Day, or... To be honest, in that period, around the Christmas season, because Christmas Day wasn't sort of so focused as it is now. People celebrated Christmas over a much wider period. That's when William Strickland, who was a probably later Puritan trader and landowner from Yorkshire, is supposed to have brought the turkey into Britain.
Ah, uh-huh. And where did turkeys come from?
They came from the New World, and... The name is very odd. Nobody really knows why they're called turkey, but it's supposed that they were called turkey cocks, perhaps because they were like guinea fowl, or perhaps because people thought they came through Turkey. But anyway, that's the name we've ended up with. So the 1520s were a really interesting decade, really, to bring this meat back, because so much was happening around then. You obviously have the Reformation, and you have this kind of abandonment of Catholic ideas of food, which are very significant. You have this emerging middle class, as we all know from Hilary Mantel's brilliant novels, you know, where people like Thomas Cromwell were having more say in the way that things happened. And what another very interesting person besides Cromwell is somebody like Erasmus, for example, who wrote this book on the civility of children, and he's saying, I am a kind of, as an intellectual, as a middle class intellectual, and telling you, the aristocracy, how to behave. And more true nobility comes from my background than from all the kind of poncing around, you know, in suits of armour and things. So that was very significant. And then there's a sort of growing need for, it came at just the right time, because there was this growing need for meat. You know, the population was beginning to explode, and there just wasn't enough meat to go around. And later, you know, Edward VI and Elizabeth I started trying to kind of get people to eat more fish, because, you know, there just wasn't quite enough livestock to go around. And so the turkey comes in at a time when it gets adopted immediately by much more of a sort of middle class, really, you know, than most meats were kind of seen as. So the kind of pre-Reformation idea of what was on your Christmas table depended entirely on who you were. And the ones, obviously, we know most about are the big landowners and the aristocracy and the lords and ladies. And we know that what they have is just a huge amount of meat, particularly game and particularly venison. And that's the thing that everybody goes mad about at Christmas.
But also peacock and swan.
Also sometimes. Those things, peacock right? and swan. And since there aren't quite enough animals to go around, they even invented some. You know, the cooks would sew a capon onto the back of a pig, and you'd invent this kind of cockatrice and all sorts of things.
And extraordinary idea.
Extraordinary. and you know, and bitterns and you know, big beasts and porpoises were eaten on fast days, because the idea was that they were fish, and you know, you could get around the
rules.
Those restrictions and all the rest of it. So you've gone from this kind of aristocratic, very dominated by this kind of aristocratic ideas of meat, together with these ideas, Catholic ideas of fasting. It's really interesting pre-Reformation, because before this kind of understanding of husbandry that you get around the 17th century, you have to eat all your meat up around Christmas because you and your livestock are going to be competing for the same grain. On Martinmas on the 11th of November, you start to slaughter your cattle, you slaughter your pigs. That's when your wild animals are at their sleekest. And that's why you have this great big blowout at Christmas, because there's probably not enough food to go around for all of you. You have to slaughter your animals and you'll salt some of them, but some of them you want to eat fresh.
And then just try and get through February and March.
Well, that's why you have Lent.
Oh, of course.
Because you have so few animals left, so little livestock left. You have to give them chance to reproduce. And so the church and the agricultural year buttress each other in saying, okay, don't eat eggs, dairy, meat during Lent, because otherwise, you know, your livestock are not going to get a chance to reproduce.
That's so interesting. So do you think it's possible that that was just a sort of pre-Christian necessity that then the Christian religion sort of took on as one of their traditions because it was a sort of pre-existing aspect of society? Or do you think that's a bit like Easter? You know, I mean, Easter's eggs and rabbits haven't really got anything to do with the crucifixion.
Yes, exactly. I think so. And they kind of supported each other.
OK.
You know, it suited the church, and it suited the church, you know, to keep people kind of pure.
Yeah.
And keep people. But it also suited the agricultural year, and the church kind of, you know, waded in and made sure that people behaved themselves. And then, of course, you get to the Reformation and everything is just a bit harder. And people start kind of pushing those barriers.
Mm.
And so, like I say, the turkey comes at a really, really useful time.
And how did it... So this man, I can't remember his name...
William Strickland.
William Strickland, yeah, arrives presumably with more than one turkey. I mean, there must have been a few. And then did he sort of sell them on to farmers who then began to breed them? How did they sort of become established as a...
Yes, I think it becomes a farmyard meat almost immediately. So it's not seen as an aristocratic meat in the same way that game is or venison is, for example. And so quite quickly you get this this great farmer, landowner and poet called Thomas Tusser.
Mm.
And he writes these 500 points of good husbandry just in 1573, so about 50 years later. And he's telling you how to be a farmer, how to kind of keep everything going, you know, how to look after your animals, but also how to live well with the land in the year. And he already sees it at that stage as a Christmas meat. You know, you eat it with brawn, you eat it with what he calls shred pies, which are probably mince pies.
Okay.
And then a little bit later, you have somebody called Gervase Markham, who he wrote all kinds of books on all kinds of different subjects, including telling the housewife how to kind of be a good housewife. There's no evidence he particularly knew himself what the answer was. But he calls it a lesser landfowl. So,
right.
You know, it has this kind of status as being generally available to farmers, yeomen, and, you know, people with a good standard of living.
Yeah.
And obviously it's adopted for the aristocratic table as well. But it's not a key meat for them in the way that it is for the kind of middling sort.
Yeah.
I'm saying this with inverted commas.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Yeah, and yeah. As I'm sure most people will be well aware, another thing that was brought over from America around the same time, I think, is another big feature of today's Christmas lunch, which is, of course, potatoes.
Yes.
But they, you say in your book, they didn't sort of, they took much, much longer to really be taken to the British hearts.
Well, yes, and it's very difficult to know why. It's possible because they come from South America, they come from the Andes, they were seen as totally peasant, maybe for some reason, you know, because of that. I think meat is always much more quickly adopted in Britain than vegetables.
Yeah.
And so if you look at potatoes, tomatoes, avocados, it's taken them centuries to be adopted.
Yeah, well, avocados especially.
Yes.
I mean, that's very, very recent,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But it is astonishing, though, if you think about the potato and you think about chips and, you know, I mean, the many, many incarnations of potato, which we all eat on a daily
yes.
basis. And, you know, you think of the potato as being a real symbol of the British kitchen. And yet, you know, we've only had them for a few hundred years. I mean, what do people eat before potatoes?
Bread. We were a bread nation, and it was seen, and the kind of bread as an icon of your status and your class and your rights was very, very powerful. And so there are all these sort of quiet wars going on about who got to eat what kind of bread. Mm. And, you know, the kind of upper classes will say, you know, well, obviously we get the nice white bread, you know, which is flour that's sifted three times and all the rest of it. But you workers, because you have big peasant digestions, but you will need cheap, you know, fodder, you should be eating brown bread. And it wasn't very popular. And so, you know, as the kind of decades and centuries changed, people were more and more likely to just demand to have white bread. And it wasn't until around the late 18th century where you start to get people who are much more sort of metrical about recording what people ate. So you get this great guy called David Davis, who was a Welsh vicar. And he said, I really want to know what the poor actually eat, because we always say this is what they should eat, but I'm going to record it. So he gets his other vicars to send in a kind of note of what their neighbours are eating. And he says, well, you know, these are the people, they sow the wheat.
Yeah.
They do all the work. They do the threshing. They are the bakers. So why shouldn't they eat white bread? Why should it just be for the kind of upper classes? And so, you know, you get lots of kind of interventions in the bread debate.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, let's move on, shall we, to scene two, which is just over 100 years later. Can you tell us where we're going next?
Well, I think, again, it's a kind of pivot, really, between, you know, Puritans and the kind of Restoration. So we'll go to about the 1660s. And the Puritan idea of Christmas, so, you know, nobody ever seems quite sure whether the Puritans actually banned Christmas or not. Or whether they just said, oh, you know, it's just not really a very good idea. And, you know, it falls on a fast day. And you know, Christmas falls on a fast day this year, so you'd be better off not eating whatever you want to eat. And it's true, you know, the Puritans did attack this, you know, the aristocracy for their undoubted excesses at Christmas. And it wasn't just food, you know, it was dancing, parties, play acting, lots of drink and all the rest of it. But I think probably where the Puritans erred in sort of in propaganda terms was attacking the poor as well. And Christmas was perhaps the only time of year that most people, poor people, would actually get anything fun to eat at all. And, you know, they didn't want to give it up. And why should they? There's a puritanical news sheet called The Flying Eagle from 1652. And it says, you know, the poor will pawn all the clothes of their back to provide Christmas pies for their bellies and the broth of abominable things in their vessels. And the poor just went, yep, we will, because, you know, it tastes good and we want to keep it.
Yeah, and we want a treat.
We want a treat, thanks very much. You know, I mean, the Puritans obviously hadn't, you know, been reading the Nobel Prize winners, Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee, who say, or George Orwell, who say, you know, that's what poor people need. They need a treat to, you know, last them from one kind of miserable episode to the next. But what's interesting, I suppose, from the kind of food perspective is what they mean by Christmas pies and what they mean by abominable, the broth of abominable things. And so, again, Christmas pies are probably the mince pies. And they would have had, you know, things like spices and dried fruit, which would be seen as very, very excessive. And also at that time, still meat. And the meat would change. You know, so you might have had steak if you were kind of had the money, but it might just be tongue or heart or something, or kind of chopped up. And as we know, you know, that's now been replaced by just suet. We tend not to have meat in our mince pies anymore.
Yes, so that's that's something that really came across, was that well, first of all, specifically with mince meat, and I had always wondered as a child why on earth they were called, well, why it was called mincemeat and mince. I mean, it did seem strange, but it was very popular, wasn't it, to eat meat with a bit of sugar and spices sort of cooked together. That was a real feature of food.
It was a real feature, and sugar was really so rare that it was really just treated as another spice, you know, a few teaspoons of sugar.
When did we first start eating sugar?
Well, I mean, we've had sugar since Roman times, so it's very difficult to really pinpoint it. And obviously, you know, as we've kind of grown, you know, imported sugar from the West Indies and everything, you know, our sugar consumption, it's got cheaper and cheaper, and our sugar consumption has just grown and grown. But we've always, I mean, in Anglo-Saxon times, they probably didn't have sugar. They probably just had honey as a sweetener.
Yeah.
But I think the Romans had sugar. So it's difficult to pinpoint that moment. But the growth of abominable things is quite interesting, because he's not saying at that stage Christmas pudding or plum pudding, because what you had to go with your Christmas meat was a kind of a potage, you know, would be some grain or some breadcrumbs with, again, the spices, the dried fruit, a bit of sugar and all the rest of it. And that, interestingly, if that sounds a bit like Christmas pudding, it's because some genius learns how to turn that potage into a pudding by greasing a cloth, putting some flour on it, pouring the potage in it, and it might be that stuff, or it might be peas potage, you know, and then binding it all up and boiling it for a few hours. And that's why you get those lovely old-fashioned kind of round cannonball-shaped Christmas puds or plum puds.
And that would have been eaten with the meat, so it wasn't a dessert at all.
So that would have been eaten with the meat, because in these days, in the 17th century, you tended to get sweet and savoury food on the table at the same time. Everything was all kind of, you might have two courses, but everything tended to, you might have 20, well, it depends how wealthy you are, obviously. Mm. You might have 20 dishes, and of those 20 dishes, a lot of them would be roast meats and pies and things, but some of them would be sweet as well.
But they'd all be out together. You wouldn't kind of sit and have your first course and your...
No, they'd all be out together, or laid on the table together. And that doesn't really change until the beginning of the 19th century.
That's so interesting. And what do you know, why that changed? Like, what was there any particular...
It changed probably because the instigator was the Russian ambassador in Paris, who I think in 1812 served dinner in a different style. So instead of everything being on the table all at once, he served it one course after the other, after the other, after the other, in the way that we'd recognise now as a kind of how you'd be served in a restaurant, for example.
Hmm.
And it came to be known as the à la Russe style of dining. And it came to be the kind of grand style of dining, how you'd be served at a banquet or something. And it was used as a kind of signifier of, you know, class and status. Whereas the old-fashioned, everything on the table all at once style that we still have, in fact, at kind of family dinners for Christmas, you know, that starts to be seen as a little bit kind of déclassé and a little bit old fashioned. And that was sort of called the à la Française style of dining.
Okay. Always French. And, yeah. Always French.
Yes. Yes.
We were always looking over the channel with sort of slight inferiority complex, weren't we? Sometimes with
good reason, and yes.
Yeah. I like your chapter on gravy, which I think we should also mention. I don't know whether they were eating gravy with their turkey at this point, but just talk a little bit about the gravy wars and the whole... I thought that was great.
Yeah, so gravy came to be, like I was just saying about pudding, you know, the British or the English were seen as the inventors of pudding. And the French went, yep, that's fair enough. We'll allow you, you know, that invention. You're welcome to it. And gravy was a sort of similar idea. So whereas French chefs and French trained chefs in this country were all about this kind of concentration of flavour into a small amount of very delicate, you know, jus or, you know, sauce or something, gravy came to be associated with a particularly British way of roasting meat, where all the juice of the meat kind of falls out of the meat as it turns on the spit in front of the fire and gets channeled into this great big lavish, you know, splash it all over kind of gravy. And it becomes a bit ironic because sometimes cooks would slash the meat to make more gravy come out because everybody wants more gravy, and then the meat gets dry, so you need more gravy. And the French are looking at us going, oh, for goodness sake, you know, what are they like?
Is there anything else that they would have been eating in the 1660s around Christmas?
Well, after the Restoration, obviously there was a huge amount of interest in kind of newly fashionable things and newly kind of luxurious things, and such as mead, the famous venison pasty, jellies, champagnes, and wines and things. And also objects, you know, also tableware. Things like all the kind of puritanical ideas of very basic functional tableware, such as knives with very sharp points, that comes to an end. And you have the new shape of the knife with a kind of rounded point, and people start buying silverware and glassware and a lot of china for their tables. So the table looks different, and it begins to have different food on it.
So after these years of under the Puritans, and everything was sort of fairly depressing, and you know, there wasn't a lot of overindulgence, was there a huge period of hedonism in the Restoration with regards to food, and did, you know, certain things come back in that hadn't been eaten, for example?
Yes, and at Christmas time, you'd get to eat what there is available, and it depends on how much disposable income you've got. But you start to get this idea of fresh fruit, or a fruit anyway, being a kind of significant part of a diet, because it looks so kind of elegant, you know, in a supper. Mm. And things like the thing that Pepys is really obsessed about, and I think I can't remember how many times he mentions it in his diaries, but he's obsessed with this idea of the venison pasty, which is a very kind of Christmassy dish. And again, venison, because it's not something you can buy in the shops. You need to have a deer park, or you need to have friends with a deer park to have.
So it's very elite.
It's incredibly elite. And his patron sends him, Lord Hinchinbrooke from Northamptonshire, I think, sends him half a buck. And he's so pleased with it. And he gives it his mum and gets her to make him a venison pasty. And they are extraordinary, enormous kind of constructions with a, you know, with, it might be a shoulder or a leg of venison, and not a pasty as we think now, with it all kind of chopped
up.
So
you wouldn't be able to have it in your hand and
eat it like a it. It's so not a Cornish pasty.
Okay.
Yeah.
You just talk a bit about the history of, because it's very, very, I mean, this is obviously going much, much further back in history again, but it's a very interesting, so where the whole thing of hunting and venison, just elaborate a bit on that, please.
So it becomes part of the hierarchy of the aristocracy, that access to game, particularly venison, you know, from the Norman Conquest onwards and all that.
Because they were obsessed with hunting.
They were
obsessed
with hunting. Yeah, they seemed to be obsessed with hunting. And, you know, they put aside all this land for kind of hunting parks and game parks and deer parks, which was then became inaccessible to, you know, to peasants for their own, you know, foraging and grazing their own livestock and that sort of thing. So lots of.
But they weren't
clashes.
Allowed to kill the deer, though, were they?
They definitely weren't allowed to. Yes, if you killed it, I mean, even if you killed a rabbit, you know, you'd be in big trouble, which is a problem, yeah. Because rabbits don't know this. They don't know they're supposed to stick to the areas that, you know, they're put aside for them.
Actually, on last week's podcast, I was talking to Charles Spencer about the Normans, and we did have quite a lot of conversation about, you know, their punishments and how they would happily blind you for having done something.
Putting eyes out and chopping hands off and things. Yes, absolutely draconian.
But actually, I wanted to ask you a question related to that, because he told me that, I think it was Henry I died after eating a surfeit of lampreys. And I wondered, what is a lamprey? Can you shed any light on that? What is it? Is it a type of fish or sort of sea creature?
A lamprey is a kind of, it's a bit like an eel. And yes, it's a long fish. And they are used these days for fishing bait, I think, as much as anything. But okay. A lamprey pie was quite a traditional thing. I think somebody even cooked a lamprey pie for Queen Elizabeth II's coronation as a sort of historical curiosity more than anything else. But they, like eels, they've sort of disappeared from off our tables. We don't think that they're, you know, the kind of thing that you'd eat anymore.
No. Well, thank you for clearing that up for me. That's great.
Hello, it's Artemis, one of the presenters on this podcast. You'll know that we've been working with the visual historian Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph over the last few months to bring moments from our episodes to life, whether it's shots of the Beatles in 1964 or Oscar Wilde in 1882. Well, these wonderful colourised historical images and many more are available for purchase as museum-grade, archive-quality art prints at colourgraph.co. They make unusual, compelling, and just really cool Christmas presents for that history fan in your life. And what's more, a selection of some of the very best prints are now available in a smaller size and for a smaller price. So for just £23, or $30, you can get a fascinating image of the Titanic, or Mark Twain, Fidel Castro, or Abraham Lincoln. Check out the full range at colourgraph.co. And remember, if you add the code TTT at the checkout, you get an extra 10% off.
All right, well, shall we go on to our third scene now, which is definitely one of the moments in history when we do really think of Christmas. It's sort of when Christmas was kind of invented, really, the kind of Christmas that we have today, wasn't it? So can you tell us where we're going?
Yes. Well, it's much easier to pinpoint this year because it is 1843. It's the year that Dickens published A Christmas Carol, and I think he published it right at the beginning of December, and it just was this overnight sensation. It was a complete success. And what was interesting in food terms about the Christmas Carol is that all these ideas, as we said right at the beginning of this conversation, Christmas was a much longer period. And, you know, we have turkey, but people also had goose and they had venison and they had beef. You know, beef was the thing you had at Christmas if you were the kind of, you know, stalwart yeoman kind of middling sort of this country. You'd be very, very proud of your roast beef. And what happens with A Christmas Carol is that Dickens, because he has this extraordinary kind of imagination, takes some of these elements and he anchors them to one specific day, to Christmas Day, through the kind of Cratchit family. And if you look at what they're eating, it's quite interesting because in the Christmas present, the Cratchits are eating a goose, because that's what you ate if you were poor. You had goose clubs, particularly in urban areas. And you would, like Christmas clubs, you know, you pay a bit of money into them.
Yeah.
And they're often held by landlords of pubs. And, you know, some people didn't like them. They were associated with a bit of kind of looseness or drunkenness or whatever.
Yeah.
And at the end of your advent, you got your goose. And so that's a very typical thing for a kind of poor, not very, very poor, but, you know, that somebody like the Cratchit family was, there's not much spare cash to go round. They might have a little goose. And then what Scrooge gives them is a turkey, which is much bigger, more kind of bountiful flesh. And it still has that element of being the sort of wealthy, urban, middle class, you know, people with resources. They get to eat their turkey. There's an expression in one of Jane Austen's characters. She talks about the myrtle and turkey part of happiness, meaning the money, you know,
right.
The
okay.
stuff that you get at Christmas if you've got the wherewithal. So the whole of Britain kind of moves to turkey focus. And from that moment, turkey begins to overtake roast beef in the minds of the great mass of the population as the thing to have at Christmas. Mrs. Beaton has this great phrase. She says, "For the middle classes of this empire, Christmas would not be Christmas without its turkey." And so that by 1861, you know, it really has kind of...
been cemented.
It has really cemented, yeah. And the other thing that Dickens does really interestingly with food on this day is he takes this idea of the plum pudding, which if you read A Christmas Carol, there's no references to Christmas pudding anywhere. Up to that moment, it was a plum pudding. It was a pudding of plums, and plums just means dried fruit and good things.
Yeah, so it doesn't mean actual plums.
It means good stuff, you know, like the plum job, the plum roll or whatever. So he describes this, you know, this, it has a bit of holly on the top and he has some spirit, you know, poured over it. It's all aflame. So we kind of recognise it as a round cannonball. It's the thing that, you know, we eat or we aspire to eat. And then 2 years later, Eliza Acton, who's a very brilliant, brilliant cookery book writer, has the first recipe, or the first one that I can see, for what she calls Christmas pudding. We know that she loved Dickens because she names one of her other foods after him, Ruth Pinch's beefsteak pudding. And we know that she sent a copy of her cookery book to him. It was in his library. And she calls it the author's Christmas pudding. And I have a fancy, with absolutely no kind of historical backup whatsoever, that she's thinking about Dickens when she talks about the author, and that she's kind of attributing the plum pudding to him and calling it Christmas pudding for the first time.
And is that, is, does it resemble our modern Christmas pudding in the...
It completely does, yeah. You can cook Eliza Acton's Christmas pudding. She says it's light, and she's got a few recipes actually for plum puddings and Christmas puddings. But the particular one, the author's Christmas pudding, she says is light and rich. And it really is. It's really, it's become my go-to Christmas pudding recipe actually, because it is completely perfect, works really well. It's really delicious.
Yeah, so it's moved from being this slightly strange concoction, sort of potage concoction, to being the thing
to
that
being
we
the pudding.
Yeah,
yes.
And I also, I'd like to ask you, I don't know if this would have been on the table in 1843, but jelly featured heavily, and not the kind of jelly that our kids buy in those funny squares and then pour boiling water over. Can you talk to us a bit about jelly and its fascinating wobbly history?
Oh, always. I just love the history of jelly. So it had a long history of always something that was very elegant, very much part of a ball supper or a kind of restoration banquet, you know, or the banqueting course in the 17th century, which was actually the third course of a dinner, which might be had kind of separately for, you know, the inner sanctum of most kind of elevated guests. And jelly would be part of that course. And in the 19th century, it becomes a little bit more available to everybody. And people realise, you know, if you boil down your calf's feet, you get this kind of gelatin stuff that will more or less hold this fruit juice or champagne or whatever you want to make it out of, more or less hold it together. And so there's this, in the early 19th century and the late 18th century, there's this kind of flowering of kind of jelly art, as they call it, on Bake Off, rather fantastically. And I love that this jelly art has come back to Bake Off. That's so
yes,
great.
It's fantastic. I watched that episode.
So
I mean, it
wonderful.
Was, and it was also so tense because, I mean, how on earth you get jelly to... stay in one place and stay still.
Yeah. Yes, the jelly art of 200 years ago, you might make a Solomon's temple.
Yes,
jelly,
I read about that.
And
flummery.
Stars.
What's flummery?
Flummery is a creamy jelly. Really.
Oh, okay,
it's
like a
very
blanc
similar.
Kind
it's
of
like
thing.
A blancmange, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
But I love the idea of chefs sort of trying to outdo each other with increasingly mad designs for.
Exactly. And they can never go very high, you know, 6 inches, because jellies will just collapse. And so they started inventing kind of internal supports, you know, like little spirals and things and different ways of cheating jelly physics, yes. But it's a great thing. I mean, I love jelly as a kind of celebratory thing. And in Yorkshire, actually, traditionally, orange jelly was a kind of a very Christmassy thing. And I just think it's a great way of having a very light celebration. But we're not talking about those little squares that you make when you're a kid.
No. Well, it can be very elegant now. You get it sometimes sort of gin and tonic flavoured jelly with currants suspended in it. It can be very, very beautiful.
Oh, very beautiful. And, you know, you can, if you kind of get a concentrated fruit flavour, you know, from if you really stew the fruit and get the juice out, you can get this absolute hit of kind of, you know, deep, deep kind of fruit flavour in your jelly. Or you can turn lots of kind of cocktails into jelly, which is quite a fun thing to do.
Vodka jelly, that was definitely...
Vodka jelly. Yeah,
when I was a student, that featured at various parties. And so I'd like to ask one more question, which is really personal interest, because I really love bread sauce. And I wondered where and when bread sauce arrived, because my husband is Danish. And when I served him bread sauce for the first time, he just gave me that look as if I told, and British cuisine really is the worst on earth. And I wondered if it came from that sort of pottage stuff. Because
from that
sort
pottage,
of,
yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So it sort of separates out in a funny kind of way. You know, so you keep the breadcrumbs and the in kind of the savoury bit.
Yeah,
given
with the spices.
Given that, Yeah, yes, exactly, with the spices and the onion or whatever it is. So with the cloves or cinnamon or whatever you put it in it. Nutmeg, isn't it? And, yeah. You know, you've taken out the fruit and some of the other spices and put those into the Christmas pudding. But early recipes, there were quite a lot of medieval recipes for slightly spiced meat, for example, which are thickened with breadcrumbs. And if you taste them, if you make them and taste them, they taste a little bit like kind of a cross. It sounds so disgusting, but I promise you it's not. A cross between bread sauce and curry.
Oh no, I'm sure that would be delicious.
Yeah, it is. It's nice.
Another really surprising thing about that I discovered from your book was how long we have been eating curry for. I mean, I assumed it was sort of quite a recent thing, sort of post-empire kind of thing, but that's not true, is it?
Curry has been on our, not all of our dining tables, but a lot of dining tables since the mid-18th century. So I think Hannah Glass, who is the sort of most important cookery writer of that period, her 1747 cookbook, has a recipe for curry in. And actually, it's probably not that nice. It's kind of chicken and lots of white pepper, as far as I can remember, maybe one or two other things.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, curry was served at the beginning in coffee houses at the beginning. You could buy curry powder at the beginning of the 18th century. We've had a long relationship, you know, with the Indian subcontinent and a lot of the people.
Well, spices. I mean, the medieval kitchen was very, of a certain level, was very much.
Although they tended to be spices that had come with the Crusades back from the Holy Land. So there was a slightly different temperature of, you know, those kind of medieval spices. It was much more kind of Middle Eastern thing. Although obviously, you know, the spices didn't just come from there. They did, you know, they were traders. They came from all over the world. But it was a slightly different style of spicing to the ones that we then kind of imported, as it were, from India.
Oh, I'm getting hungry now. So I think I'm just going to ask you the final question, which is, if you could have picked something up from one of these Christmas tables, what would it be?
I am going to have Pepys's venison pasty, because a proper venison pasty done well would have looked spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
It would have, there were designs in some of the kind of cookbooks of the time showing how you'd make sort of a forest with leaves and scrolls and a deer and things. You know, you make that kind of design out of pastry, and then it would be an enormous, probably it'd be like a Fortnum and Mason hamper basically with this huge bit of venison in. And so it would look spectacular. And also it's so not a thing we do today. We don't tend to get a whole hunk of meat and put it in a pasty. You know, we like to chop our meat up and call it a Cornish pasty and give it an EU designated protection.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yes. I think that's an excellent choice. I think, I mean, I don't know how it would go down with your family if you put it on the table on Christmas Day, but I think it would look, as you say, spectacular.
And it would kind of keep you going for a while.
It would definitely keep you going.
Yeah.
Perhaps not this year. You should wait for next Christmas
when I've got a bigger family. Crowd of people, I think you're right.
This has been such a joy. Thank you for coming on for our Christmas special. It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you, Violet. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Penn Vogler taking Violet Moller on a splendid tour of Christmas through time. Penn's book is a delicious treat and a favourite of ours here. It's called Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain, and it is out right now. I mentioned at the beginning that we've rooted about in our Travels Through Time library, and we've found some fine history books to give away to you. So if you want to be in with a chance of winning a signed copy of Thomas Penn's The Brothers York, a copy of Owen Matthews' An Impeccable Spy, Stuart Clarke's book The Night Sky, and maybe a copy of my own book Endeavour, then just head over to our website, which is tttpodcast.com. And when you get there, you just have to sign up to our fortnightly newsletter. The draw takes place this Friday, so the book should arrive just in time for Christmas. Thank you again to all of you for joining us for this third season of Travels Through Time. We're going to be back in January with a new series of recordings, but until then, a Merry Christmas to you all. And in the words of Tiny Tim, God blesses everyone.